Blog Talk Radio.
This program brought to you by ProSense Productions, creators and producers of the upcoming suspense thriller, The Sick, starring Anna Margulis and Daniel Mascarilla. Visit ProSenseProductions.com for more information on how to get involved or to contribute to the Kickstarter campaign. ProSense Productions, we produce reality from imagination. This program brought to you by...
Welcome, everybody, here on Independence Day Eve. It is I, William Powell, otherwise known as Mr. Ubiquitous, and also known as the host from the coast, the sage of the stage, but most commonly known as the king of DC media. Tonight, we have a fabulous show. It's a panel discussion. I will be joined by Devin Nikki Thomas, a fabulous local actress here in the DMV, and she will be joined by directors Anthony Green and Harold Jackson III. Two excellent directors. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Let me invite you all to my stage show Benchmarks, opening July 12th at the Goethe Institute, 817 7th Street Northwest, down in good old D.C. I play a Vietnam vet suffering from PTSD. For tickets, call 866-811-4111. Let me also shout out the premiere of Coming from Africa. It's a very fine film starring the lovely and talented Wendy Bangura, who was on the show last week, and my man Blaise Pascal. It's going to be premiering Saturday, July 27th, 6 p.m. at the Carroll Arts Center in Westminster, Maryland. And don't forget to read my wonderful columns at DC Actors Examiner. You can find it by searching via Google the phrase DC Actors Examiner. So now I'm going to bring in Devin Nikki Thomas, an accomplished actress here in the DMV, and we will be joined by two directors she has worked with, Harold Jackson III and director, another excellent director in the area, Anthony Green. So let me go ahead and bring Nikki on in.
Hello.
Hey, Nikki, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good.
How's
everything this evening?
Thank you. I'm awesome.
Good.
How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Glad to have you on the show. And so I see here I have another person here on the line here. Is that Anthony Green? Hello? Hey. Hey, Anthony? Let's see who else is on the line here. Hello, Harold.
Hello.
Hey,
yes,
Harold.
Is.
This is William Powell. Hey, thanks for joining the show, man.
Oh, no, thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, great, great. And let's see if I can get Anthony on the line here. I guess he's on the line here. Okay, hold on. Let me see if we bring him in here. Hey, Anthony.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good.
That's good. That's good. Okay. So the whole idea of tonight's show is basically to see if we could just have a panel discussing about filmmaking and acting and all that great stuff. So let's just get started. Let's just plunge right in. So now, Anthony, how did you come up with the idea for the series Sick?
actually watch another web series. I think what Anthony Anderson did with Anacostia is a wonderful thing. You know, to really break down and have like a TV show format and be able to elongate and write out something that's really that that deep and involving and have the fans, you know, get behind the characters and stuff like that. I think what he accomplished was a great thing, and it was a true inspiration for me to even think about a storyline for Thick and Sit and write it down. The interesting thing about it, though, is that when really looking at the state of the web series right now and how the return of investments look and trying to get that pitch to people and get executive producers behind it, is really non-existent. So Thick is now actually a movie, and the first one that we shot is part one of a trilogy.
Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't know that. So talk a little bit about what's it about.
Okay. Thick is pretty much a high-class urban crime drama. It has LGBT themes. It has a lot of great actors from the area. It's about a woman who owns an apartment complex and oversees the crime in her own complex. So she kind of keeps it all put down into one singular place. Once the issues happen with money, stock market crashing, economics are a little messed up, the people start to get unruly in her camp and want to take over. And it's her trying to stay on top of her business while keeping her family together. So it's a really strong... Tia Day is a great actress, and normally when we see Tia Day in projects, she does bit roles, but she's a powerhouse actress. And I really wanted Sick to show off her abilities in a leading role. And also Ronald Bensonell, who's a great actor too. I don't get to see him in a lot of lead roles, so I really wanted to put something together where I could get these two great black actors to clash, and it worked out well.
So, Nikki, do you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to know what led you to tell this story now. Why right now?
As opposed to when?
Well, why is it imperative for you to tell this story at this moment instead of perhaps at a later date in a different format or something like that?
You know, honestly, when you're dealing with independent filmmaking, it's not as calculated. You get your ideas and luckily, you know, the opportunity comes up where something's ready to roll and you can roll with it. It's just that with all the other stuff that's been happening in the world, the whole DOMA thing and just all the political stuff that's going on with same-sex marriage and stuff like that, it just happened to fall into place. When I originally conceived the idea, the underlying elements were in place. And when I wrote out the storyline pretty much and had the idea together and started the script, I actually had initially lost interest and finished writing the script of it, and I turned over the latter half of it to Cheryl Brown, who I brought in to finish the script out, and then we went over it together because she kind of put a little bit more life into it. And most of the elements of it, I changed at the last minute just to make it more interesting instead of the same old thing that you're seeing. But it wasn't really about a time or this is the right time to strike with it, this is the right moment. It was just a story that I wanted to tell. It's like this. You got a bunch of stories you want to tell, and sometimes you get to tell them and sometimes you don't. And this was just the next one up the bat when I had an opportunity.
Right.
Okay, Harold, so now how did you come up with the idea for Under the Bourbon Moon? Hello? I think we might have lost him. Hold on. Okay, so while we're waiting for him to get connected here, Anthony, expand a little bit about, now, Henchman's War is a great gangster film. Now, how would you compare it to other gangster films?
I wouldn't. You know what? I like gangster films. I like the gangster genre. I like a lot of the stuff that Abel Ferreira did. He did another one after Kings of New York with Benicio del Toro and Christopher Walken. I can't remember the name of it right now. It's almost an anti-gangster movie. It has gangster tropes to it, but it's more about the psychological trip that working in that type of world and what you had to give up to get into that type of world does to you once you become seasoned and you're older and you're more reflective and you're wiser and you realize that there's really no way to get out of it and erase the past, you know? So it's just, it's really a very human type of story set in the world of criminals. And I personally, from a writer's standpoint, wouldn't sell it as a gangster movie.
Mm-hmm.
But from a producer standpoint, I would sell it as a gangster movie.
Yeah, like producing and marketing, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. All right, so let me see what happened to Harold here. Let's see if I can bring him in. Okay, Harold, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. All right, man. Okay. Yeah, I had a question for you, man. So how did you come up with the idea for Under the Bourbon Moon?
Yeah, Under the Bourbon Moon was one of those things that kind of came to me. Kind of out of nowhere. There was really no, I didn't really have a plan to, I had just done a short and I really didn't have a plan to do another short. But, I just kind of, the characters just started coming alive to me, so I decided to put pen to paper, and the story kind of told itself at that point. So I'd like to give you a really nice and sexy reason to have made the film, but it was one of those things that just kind of poured out of me, and I decided to run with it.
Okay. So, Nikki, why don't you kind of get into a little bit about what that was all about? Under the Bourbon Moon was about, and how was it to act in it?
Well, actually, it was a really great experience for me. I got a chance to really connect to the character, Jen, and really see how she interacts with the rest of the characters and just make discoveries and explore, obviously speaking just from an acting perspective. But there was a lot of love, a lot of friendship, a lot of genuine connection on set. And so I guess one of my questions would be, how do you as a director help to foster that type of environment? Like, how do you make sure that that happens if that's what you want to see reflected on film?
Yeah, for people that don't know, Bourbon Moon is about a group of friends that get together, you know, annually, and they have to go on a retreat, and they just kind of catch up with each other. And in this particular year, a lot of the secrets come out, a lot of the kind of stuff that's been bubbling under the surface kind of explodes, and we catch it this year. But to get back to your question, I knew it was about friends, and I knew it was about people who've known each other for several years, and I also knew that I was bringing in a bunch of actors that didn't know each other. So what I tried to do is just try to get everybody together as much as possible before production, and just go over the script. And we spent a lot of time really, rehearsing in a traditional sense, but we also spend a lot of time in rehearsal just talking to each other about life and about, you know, just things in general. And I wanted to do that to try to create a friendship with the people that were there, with the actors that were there, so that when we got on set and we kind of went to work, they would already feel comfortable with each other, and they would already have a natural rhythm with each other, which was really important for the film. I really wanted to establish a rhythm with the way that they talked with each other and how they interacted with each other. So it worked out really well because, you know, sometimes you get on set and there's always that one person that just doesn't quite get in line with everyone else, and it's kind of holds you back a little bit. But I really didn't have that on this particular experience. Everybody was down, everybody was on the same page, and it felt more like, you know, we had a party and we made a movie during a party rather than making a movie, period.
That's great. So now, Anthony, why did you choose directing as opposed to acting or writing?
I didn't choose it. It was Directing is a necessary evil for me. I can't say that this time with Thick, I enjoyed it a lot more than I did the first time with The Henchman's War. When you're writing, producing, and directing, and you're new at it, and it's your first time really, you know, trying to bring all these different things together, it's a lot of pros and cons to it. I think, I look at Harold's work, especially The Gifts and what he did with Byrne, and he's a really good director. You can see how assured he is, how on point he is. You can see where the schooling came into play, where that experience came into play. I don't have that type of background. So for me, directing came after I did music for films. I've done documentaries. I've done editing. And I just flew by the seat of my pants to learn how it is to sit in every seat. But it wasn't anything that was concentrated from the start. What I really enjoy doing is producing. I like greenlighting projects and trying to get stuff made and bringing people together. I like that part a lot. I like to have ideas for movies, but I do understand that there are a lot more creative people than me, and it's good to be able to work within a group of really creative people to make things happen where it wasn't really happening at first. Because you can get a rack of creative people, but they all can't get money. When it came down to directing The Henchman's War, I had to do it because there was nobody else to do, and it was such a great learning experience. I mean, it was so many things to learn, so many things to figure out, so many things to see. That the next time out, when I did Sick, I had an absolute ball because I had the game plan down. But if it was really a choice, I would stick with writing and producing. Directing comes in third.
That's a very interesting answer. Okay, Harold, the same for you. Why did you choose directing?
Well, I think that I always wanted to direct. Always, you know, even as a kid, you know, I never wanted to be a, you know, police officer or anything like that. You know what I mean? I always wanted to make films. But I've learned to love writing. But it's funny that Anthony was saying that directing is a necessary evil for him, whereas I feel producing is a necessary evil for me. So it's one of those things where I put it together, I have a vision of what it is, and I just kind of go for it, and I just kind of muscle it out on the producing end. But on the directing end, I'm more in my element, and I understand what I'm doing, when I'm doing it, why I'm doing it, and, you know, that sort of thing. So directing, I really love it. Because I love directing, I think I've learned to love writing. But, you know, sometimes you got to muscle your own films to get made if you want them to get made.
Nikki, you have a question?
Yes. You guys both are producers, and you have experience, and you know what you're doing in that realm. How do you balance the business side of it and creating a marketable film with creating something that's artistic and telling a full story? You know, because the story that you want to make may not be what someone will buy. So where's the line, and how do you balance that?
Harold knew the answer.
actually, it's one of those things, man, where I'll speak for myself. What I try to do what I've learned to try to do is make a movie that I want to see the way I think people want to see it, the way I would do it, if that makes sense.
Right, so, I know.
So it's really a balancing act between what you want as an artist and also what you've learned that people want. So I really try to create stories that I like and I enjoy, but I know that, you know, there are certain elements in film that people that need to be there and that people love. So I make it a point to kind of add those elements to the film and kind of work from a, you know, traditional story structure and kind of knock it out and do it in a traditional fashion, but also take chances where I feel chances need to be taken and so forth and so on. But again, that's just my approach, and I've seen some of Anthony's work, and I really, really like what he does. I really like his style, so I'm sure you know, he'll probably have a different approach as to how he gets it done.
You know what? It's actually where we are as independent filmmakers, we're more blessed than anything because we get to make what we want to make.
Right.
You know, we're at a point where if I want to make this type of movie that I like and I can get it made with, you know, either self-finance or a micro budget, I can do it. It's nothing
right.
in the way of that. There are people who get paid millions of dollars to make movies, but they can't make the movies they want to make. It was a documentary on Newt Wasserman who ran Universal, and when they hired Spielberg to make Jaws, Spielberg was like, well, I want to make films. And he was like, no,
right,
you make this first, and then later you get to make film.
Right.
We don't have to worry about that. We make the stuff that we love, and we get to push up. The great thing is, it's not as much as a gamble when you're dealing with micro and low budget work. And we can make the movies we want to make. We can work on knowing what our demographics are. We can point out who would look at this product. You know, we pretty much figure that when we go to the movies and see the stuff we love, and we see the people around us, we pretty much making the stuff for people like us. And as long as we know who our people are, we can just make sure that we sell the product to them. We wrap the product up with the cool posters or the cool trailers and get them in the festivals or the limited releases that we get those people to check it out. We don't have to worry about a global stage of making sure everybody loves our movie and we don't have explosions and stuff in it. You know what I mean? So it's really a thing about just you know what you are. You either making Hollywood movies or you making independent movies. You can't make a Hollywood movie on an independent budget. You know what I'm saying? You just got to know what your lane is, stay in it, make sure you love what you're doing and that you believe in what you're doing. Everything else will fall in place. But we have that freedom right now, so it's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might be great when we don't have that freedom one day because we can't pay more money, but at least for right now, we got that freedom.
So now, Harold, I want you to expand on, in your opinion, you've seen a lot of actors. It could be, you know, so-called famous actors. It could be local actors. What's your all-time favorite actor?
Oh, wow. I think I have like a group of favorite actors for different reasons. I usually like actors that really, I don't like really pretty actors, pretty good-looking people. Or perfect people, I should say. The actors I like usually are guys that look like they've seen some things, and girls that look like they are women that look like they've been through some stuff, or you know, they just have another layer to them. You know,
yeah.
They aren't just good-looking. So, a lot of my favorite actors right now are Benicio del Toro, Sean Penn. There's a young guy coming up. Named Omari Hardwick, who's going to be like really, really good. There's always like the lead man stuff. I'm a big fan of, you know, Denzel and Brad Pitt as far as leading men go. But I usually like actors that kind of bring a something else to the table, like a Jeffrey Wright or someone like that.
Oh, yeah, he's a good actor. Absolutely. How about you, Anthony?
He's a great actor. Humphrey Bogart.
Okay.
Humphrey Bogart is my favorite actor. There's no...
Wow.
There's no... You know what? I mean, with the face, the presence, the voice, he can smolder a little bit. He can smack a dude in his face. He can say his lines perfectly. He had the right swagger. And he's like one of the first and one of the best that ever did it. Casablanca is my second favorite movie. Of all time, and Humphrey Bogart is the man. Everybody who's good has his DNA in them.
I like that. That's a quote, man. That's a quote right there.
Everybody who's good got that DNA in them. If you ever pay attention to what Denzel Washington walks differently in Spike Lee movies than he does in anybody else's movies, and that swagger goes back to how Rick used to walk around his nightclub in Casablanca. I mean, the dude was incredible. He can play both sides of the fence. He can be the good guy. He could be the bad guy. He could be the gangster. He could be the lawyer. He just did it. That's my man.
Yeah, he was a good dude.
Great answer.
One of my
great
favorite
answer.
Joints is Mouthpiece Hawkins, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, wow. He had so many great ones. Key Largo and just on African Queen, there's so many. Okay, Nikki, you have another question?
Well, yeah. I mean, you just said your Casablanca was your second favorite film, so what is your favorite film and why?
Cinema Paradiso is my favorite film. It's an Italian film. It's about a young dude who grows up loving movies and how movies affect his life. I mean, my thing is, I've always been an avid movie watcher. It's not on TV, not on my laptop, but I can go in the movie theater and sit in there by myself all day and just watch movies all day, and I'll be perfectly fine with that. In this movie, this young guy grows up in a small town in Italy where going to the movies was the thing to do. It was the absolute thing to do. It was like the whole thing that brought the community together. It was how they learned how to deal with different stuff in life. And he befriends the projectionist, and they have this friendship that spans a whole lifetime. And it's one of those... It touched me. It touches me every time I see it. It came out in, I think, 88, and directed by Giuseppe Tornatore, who's a great director. Ennio Morricone did the music for it, who does a lot of stuff, you know.
Great composer.
But, yeah, it's a Cinema Paradiso is a movie for movie lovers, and it couldn't be anywhere else on my list. Except for number one, because first and foremost, I'm a film lover before a filmmaker.
Check that out.
Well, Harold, same question to you. Your favorite film and why?
My favorite film that is, for me personally, that, you know, it's a film called The Way of the Gun, and it's a really small film. It was directed by Chris McQuarrie, who actually wrote The Usual Suspects.
Written and directed by Chris McQuarrie.
Yeah,
he's a bomb writer too.
Yeah, yeah, and it actually reminds me of you know, kind of the same kind of style that Anthony does, which is, you know, it's really cerebral, and there's a lot of subtext and undertones and twists and turns and things you didn't see and things that if you didn't pay attention to, you might have missed. But it's a real interesting film. It's like me and probably like 10 other people in the world have seen it. But it's dope.
Let me
say
something. I saw it the opening night in movie theaters, man. The movie is so good. See, the thing about my movies like that and the kind of movies that I want to make, you know, there's a movie about criminals, but that's not what's on the forefront. It's really a subtext thing. It's really about how they deal with each other and the back and forth. And one of the best scenes is when Benicio Del Toro and Ryan Felipe are kind of in this situation, and it's no words. It's, Benicio doesn't say, you can see it in his face that he's making a decision whether they're going to stick it out and protect this girl or not. I mean, it's a great movie, man. It's a great movie choice. It's one of the best ones. And Sarah Silverman, she wasn't big back then, but she had a great cameo in the beginning of that.
Yeah. Everybody remembers that, man. Check it out if you get a chance. Find it. You can watch it on Netflix. I think you can stream it. So check it out, man. You'll see kind of the things that influenced me. But, you know, as far as like a big, you know, traditional, what's my favorite film, you know, it's got to be High Noon. And the reason I like that film is because the reason I like westerns, I hated westerns when I was a kid. My grandfather liked them. I thought they were stupid. You know what I mean? I was like, man, are we watching this again? But as I've gotten older, I've learned to love them because I think they're the last honest films out there, right? They tell you he's a good guy. They tell you he's a bad guy. They get the good guy, struggle, the bad guy, and then the good guy wins, and then at the end of the movie, he leaves. That's how you know the movie's over. The good guy leaves. After he kills the bad guy, he leaves town. You know?
Right.
That's the way it goes. So I really love High Noon. It's a really simple premise. You know, these criminals are coming to town. What is this guy going to do about it? And you watch them you know, even for an older film, a black and white film, you kind of watch them go through a lot of emotional ups and downs at a time when you don't really think that that's the way things work. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more to it than what it is on face value. So I really like that film, man. And then it counts down to the end, and you know it's coming, but you still, you know, on the edge of your seat. You know, I love that film. So,
yeah,
so that's
that
my
good.
Traditional.
It's a good build-up. Western movies, period, man.
Yeah.
Western movies don't get their due nowadays.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my favorite genres, too. There's so many archetypes. There's so much going on. I mean, High Noon had a lot of subtext in it. I mean, at the time, I think that
it was
written by a guy that was blacklisted, and I think that John Wayne didn't like it, and it had a whole lot of political stuff going on there.
Yeah, political stuff, interracial relationships. It was just way ahead of its time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, Harold, I want you to talk a little about I saw your film, The Gift. Now, what should viewers take from your film, and not only from your film, but from Proverbs 18:22?
Yeah, Proverbs 18:22 is kind of paraphrasing it. It says that a good wife is a gift from God. So, you know, you should cherish that. That's the overarching theme of the Proverbs, and the film is really about a guy who's kind of been searching for success, and he finds that in his mind, when he kind of lets go of all of kind of who he was and kind of takes on this new persona, that he becomes more successful. And once he kind of crosses that threshold, he can't really understand why everyone else doesn't cross it with him. So he almost alienates himself in searching for the one thing that he wanted to have for everyone involved. So it really brings a huge strain on this relationship. And, you know, I don't want to go into how it ends, but, you know, I guess what people should take from that is that, you know, life is, we're all chasing something. We all want to be, I want to be a director that I can live off of directing, and I want to make films, and I want to, you know, on my grave, I wanted to say a filmmaker, you know, that's what I want. But a lot of times in that kind of charge to get what you want, you can lose sight of all the things that are around you. And you just have to, in my opinion, you have to understand that life is not this race to the top. Life is the things that happen during the race to the top. So just to not lose sight of the things that are around you, the things that you've been blessed with, and the things that are important to you, you know, you need to really keep that in the forefront of your mind as you go on your journey in life, whatever that is.
Yeah, as John Lennon said, it's that life is what happens while you're making other plans.
Right, exactly.
So let's move on to, now, Anthony, in that same vein, what would you say is the central lesson of Henchman's War?
I used to know that. you know what? The thing about Henchman's War is, and honestly, I mean, I really haven't talked about it yet, but Emeril Leach, who's a great horror and sci-fi writer out in San Diego, she and I collaborated on the book for the Henchman's War. That's pretty much done now. It was in the last editing phase. And it takes place, it's like a prequel to the movie, and then it picks up where the movie begins and tells the story based on my original script. And when you see the movie, you know, it's one thing, but when you sit back and look at, you know, when you read the book and see the movie, the whole thing you sit back and see is that it's about regrets. It's about the things that you can't say you're sorry for. It's about the things that you can't change about your past. And, you know, some people, you know, especially in that lifestyle for Robert Lindbergh's character, Tubby Wagner, and Rick King's character, who just did a great job in Michael Vinsky's The Next Day. their characters are on both sides of the spectrum. One's a boss, one is his henchman. And uh-huh. both of them, you know, when they first crossed paths, you know, it was something that, you know, they could never take back. It was going to go on for the rest of their lives. And it gets to the point where it becomes something that they have to come back and face from two different sides of the spectrum 20 years later. And I think that everybody, you know, when we get older, we have those times when we think back on our past and wish that we did things differently, wish that we treated somebody differently or said this in the moment where we should have stood up for ourselves or when we were standing up for ourselves a little bit too much and wasn't really thinking about, you know, being diplomatic with the other person's feelings. And that's pretty much what it's about. When I originally set out to do the Henchman's War, I was looking at it as an American foreign film. I wanted it to have more subtext than action. You know, I wanted the action to be there because when you have those beats, that's what keeps people interested. But, you know, the conversations were the media things for me that I really wanted to make sure came across. And, you know, how people felt about each other and the actions that they had towards each other. I think the finished product of the movie that we finally, you know, we got it done. Studio Unknown, Kevin Hilton did a great job with the sound design and stuff. The finished movie settles that for me. And then the book takes it that extra mile because everything is in there. You know how it all started. You know who everybody is from the beginning, who made it, who didn't make it to 20 years later. And then you get more of an introspective understanding with the stuff that I wasn't able to put into the movie is in the book. So when you really break it down, it's really about regret. It's really about putting yourself in a predicament or making decisions in life that, you know, maybe you should have did things differently or maybe if this one little thing had turned this way, and there's really nothing you can do about it. It's just that, period.
Nikki, you had a question?
Yeah, it's actually going a little bit further back. So we went to your previous work. I wanted to know how your background has shaped your storytelling, your upbringing. How has it shaped your creative perspective? Taking it way back. That's for both of you.
Okay. Okay. Maybe you want to jump in there?
How my background? I keep messing up. Now, you know what? It's simple. As a storyteller, the biggest thing for storytellers is what they ingest. You know, things that you see, things that you hear, the way you look at life, the way you process conversations, the way things come in really makes a difference on how they come back out again when you're a storyteller. So I can be inspired from a small sentence in the Stephen King book to write a whole story based on one minimal throwaway idea or be listening to a Van Hunt song or watching a Takashi Miike movie. I mean, all these different things. You can go to the museum and just see something, the modern art or something like that. And the smallest things are like the seeds to start this big interest in making something whole from something else. I think as a storyteller, you know, all the stuff that I ended up getting into over the years, which was really a open door from watching horror films when I was little, you know, and then branching off into different genres and then, you know, going through the whole black exploitation thing and then watching all the Italian giallo movies and then, like, all that stuff is embedded in me somewhere, some way. And when I start to write, it starts to regurgitate and form into its own thing from everything that I've liked coming up. So, you know, we take that, then you throw in your life experiences, the things you go through. Like, I think for the most part, most of the projects I've worked on, but really all of the projects I've worked on, whether it's dealing with insecurities, whether it's dealing with something that I wish I could have said to somebody, or like Henchman's War, dealing with my own regrets of decisions I made in my own past or people I've let down or things that I think I could have done differently. You know, I'm in everything. I'm in there one way or another, you know. I mean, it's just as a creator, that's what you are. When you create your art, you're in there some kind of way. You know, you might never really know which character I think is most like me, or what I was really trying to say to who when I wrote that, but I'm in there some kind of way. And I think that's, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's the DNA for most artists when they're creating something. There's something about them that's in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think a really good screenwriter can't write a movie that's not about them. And I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. I mean, even if the character is, somebody completely different from them, a geologist or something, you know, in order for me to write that character, he or she has to be dealing with things that I understand, right? And then I can springboard from there. So I just said that to kind of piggyback on what Anthony was saying. I mean, I don't think a screenwriter that really loves making movies can tell you that there's nothing about them in the movie. It's all about these superficial characters that they created because they're that good. I just don't think you can do that. But I guess to answer your question, Devin, I'm naturally a pretty quiet guy. I've learned to talk a little more just because I need to get people's attention. But my family isn't. You know, my family's really loud, boisterous. They talk to the TV and that's them. You know, I love them to death. That's them. So as a kid, I really would kind of sit in the back and watch them really interact with films. And that was, those are the memories that I have about my family. And I think that's what really influences me. And my natural nature is to be a pretty pensive guy or cerebral and to overthink a lot of things. So I think my style is just kind of finding a way to be myself and overthink and be and really cerebral and really go deep in emotions and but do it in a way that you can yell at the screen and throw popcorn at the screen. You know, so I really think that's the balance that I try to create when I'm making a film. You know, it's really a combination of the types of things that I feel with trying to get some sort of emotion out of the audience, out of the viewer. And if I can do that, I think I'm pretty successful at it.
So, Harold, we're going to continue in that vein. We're going to change directors and talk about what advice would you give actors when they audition?
When they audition for me or when they audition?
Yeah, when they audition for you. Yeah, when they audition for you.
Yeah, when you audition for me, I would probably tell you whatever side that I give you or whatever, you know, lines that I give you to audition for, I'm probably not going for the surface reaction of the line.
Mm.
So if the character's angry in the scene, in all honesty, with my work, it's probably appearing to be anger, but it's really coming from a place of insecurity, or it's appearing to be anger, but it's really coming from a place of protection. So to audition for me is to really take the material and I know that's hard to do because you don't have the whole script, you don't have the background and so forth and so on, and it's a real tendency to play it the way it says on the script. But I think, to audition for me is to not play what it says on the script, find the truth in it and play the truth. And if it sounds like anger, that's okay because I know it's coming from a place of insecurity, which is exactly where I wanted you to be, if any of that makes sense.
That drives a lot of actors crazy because there's so little time a lot of times in auditions to really prepare and try to get there in such a short period of time. So, Anthony, so same question for you. What do you look for? What advice would you give actors that audition for you?
The biggest problem that I see the actors have. I mean, you know, it's, you're coming in the room to be judged.
Yeah.
And you're being judged by most of the time people you don't know. And then if you do know them, it's even worse because you're being judged by people you do know. so I know that's kind of nerve-wracking. You know, I get it that's nerve-wracking. But you got to, the first thing you got to do is act like you belong in. You know?
Right.
Because if I know that you act like you belong there when you come in the audition, I know you're going to act like you belong there when you're on the set.
Right.
That's my first thing. Whatever you're doing, act like you belong. Even if you don't know what the hell you're doing, act like you know what you're doing. You know what I'm saying?
That's, right.
But another thing that that hurts actors is that they spend too much time trying to act. You know,
uh-huh.
Let me tell you the biggest problem I had with Thick. With Thick, the main character is a black woman who's intelligent, smart, ruthless, powerful, you know, and you don't see it a lot. You know, this is before Scandal came on TV. So before Scandal came on TV, somebody tell me where they saw that at, you know? And I had people coming in reading the lines like it was out of a Tyler Perry movie and shit. I'm sorry, I don't know if I can cuss on your show. But,
sure.
You know, people just, you know, they just didn't want to just come in and just believe in, you know, my thing is be yourself first. And we can build the character up out of that. If you come in and then you're going too far over the bridge trying to be a caricature of what you think it's supposed to be to begin with, that's automatically something I got to sift through to bring it back out again. Now, if it's one thing if I'm just directing, but if I'm writing, directing, and producing, making sure people eating and stuff like that, going back and forth with the EP, making sure we got what we need, I need you to at least come to the table with a little bit more assertiveness and assuredness in your craft. Not just mimicking what you see actors do on TV, but having some assuredness in your craft within itself. And that's one thing that really, really gets in people's way. They just come in and they say the lines based on initially what they think. And it's no problem to take a minute to ask a question. Ask me. I have an idea, but is it better to do this way? Because that type of rapport means that you're directable and you and I are going to get along and talk about it. Because I don't want to get to the day when we're on set and there's 40 people around me and then you come ask me. But I know from that very first meeting that you and I are going to talk about this, and then when I give you my direction and we go back and forth, we can work together. It's a work-together thing. But the biggest issue for actors is all directors aren't the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be times when you don't have a director in the room, just a casting director. So I would think that you break it down as much as possible and not make it into a caricature first, because that can shoot you in the foot. And I've seen it happen a lot. With Sick, I had people just come in and just say these lines like on some insaneness. Like it just didn't even, it was mind-boggling. Then I also had people who weren't brave enough to just talk to me about anything that they were worried about. I had people who just didn't show up. Because they don't think was going to have these crazy sex scenes and stuff in and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know, it's not that serious. It's not even about that. That's not even what that's just a subtext thing. It's not about having nipples all up in the camera and stuff like that. But because they didn't say anything to me and didn't talk to me about it, they just didn't want to come to callbacks. They was just like, you know, my religion won't let me do it. Like, people was having real problems with that. And I'm not the person that says, well, you're an actor, deal with it, because you're still a person. You're still a human being. You still got your family. You still got, you know, your kids. You still got your church. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not going to just chalk it up to being, well, you're an actor. You're supposed to be able to do it. I'm not going to say that. But what I will say is, let's have a conversation about that. Let's talk about that. We can make something happen on screen that ain't never happened. I mean, haven't you seen Gremlins? They're not real. So... you know, it's really, those are the real interesting things to me when it comes down to dealing with actors. Be self assured, don't overact yourself out of a job, and talk to the people and make sure that you have an understanding of where they're coming from, because it's not just me, or it's not just you auditioning for me. I'm auditioning for you. You got to make a decision if you want to deal with me or not. You shouldn't have to be on the set with an asshole. You know what I mean? You might not like me. So, you know, then you got to sit there and be in front of me all day. And then it's micro budget. You ain't getting paid that much, if anything, at all. Why would you even put yourself through it? You know, we both end up hating each other. So, but yeah, those things really need to be taken into consideration. Actors need to really understand the power that they have, because we can't make the movies without you. We need you there. We all need to get along and work together. Everybody has a dream. We all got to work together to make it happen.
Yeah, and just to kind of piggyback on that, man, one of my pet peeves, and Anthony hit a kind of nail on the head. One of my pet peeves with actors is crying on camera. It seems like, and the reason it looks ridiculous most of the time is because actors are trying to cry. And in real life, nobody tries to cry. Crying is an involuntary act, right? It happens most of the time without you wanting it to happen. You know, so. And it comes from something else. It doesn't come from your face. It comes from your gut. It comes from your heart. You know what I mean? So it's little things like that, that Anthony's right. You do get, initially, you get a lot of people that get in the audition room and they go to 10 when I really only need you at 4. You see what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, definitely. They go all the way up.
Right.
Screaming down the hallway and stuff, and it's just like, just come on, man, reel it back in. Because, you know, in real life, when you're in an argument with somebody, you're really pissed off, you ain't screaming. When you're threatening somebody, telling them to leave the hell alone, you ain't going to scream it. It's going to be really intimate. It's going to be really one-to-one. It's going to be low, so only they can hear it, and you're going to be pissed. But, you know, if people just stop overacting, just trying to act instead of just being, it works better for them, because then you can mold it and build up from it.
Right. Yeah. And Harold, yeah, that was interesting. I cannot remember the young lady's name, but the lady that played the wife in The Gift. I mean, she really had she had to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting. That I thought she had a very good performance.
Yeah, she was wonderful. Her name is Nedra McClyde. She's an actor out of New York, and she just came on, and it was like, you know, somebody turned the lights on, and it was super dope. So I was really lucky to have her on the film.
Right.
Yeah, it was a very subtle performance, but she was there. Her presence was there. Very subtle performance, but the presence was there. And when she threw a jab, she asked him how come they wasn't having sex no more. It really, really popped. You know what I mean? Because it came out of left field. It caught the whole audience off guard. So she did her timing and everything. It was really right on.
Yeah. Nikki, you had another question?
Yeah, this is really for an actor, for someone who is just kind of starting into this industry. It's really gold to listen to two directors speak about auditions and what they look for, and the importance of finding truth in subtext, and it's just great. Thank you guys for that. The question that I have is, so let's say we're past the audition stage and you're kind of on the fence about an actor because you see that there is something craftable. There's something, oh, okay, so there's something special about this one, but they're kind of either overacting or not quite there, but you see a spark. Can you describe some of the factors that would lead you to cast that person? What would lead you to cast that person? I know that's tough. I know that's really, you know, but.
Yeah, for me, it's, you know, I usually have, when I'm writing a film, I usually have, visually, I have the look. Sometimes I even know who I want in the film. So I write it sometimes with their voice in my head. But I guess I don't know if there's a way. I don't know if I have a way. I just know when I see something, and I know when there's an actor I can work with. I usually try to give them in the audition. If they come in at 10, I usually try to tell them to go to 1, And then if they go to 8, then I know, okay, that's not the right person for the job. But if they go to 3, then I know, okay, so they can listen, they can understand what I want and try to find it. And now that's when I kind of believe if I lean forward a little bit, you'll lean forward a little bit, and we can get the job done. So if I tell you, okay, no, 1 really looks like this, then I believe you can do that because you got close to it just on your own with just one little slight direction. Does that make sense? So if I see the person that looks right and their performance is wrong, I try to give them an opposite direction just to see if they can do it. And if they can do it, then that tells me that I can work with them. If they can't do it, then that tells me, well, they already have their mind made up about what this character is, and it's just going to be a hassle for the rest of the film. And that's something I don't want to deal with.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of little bit of things. I mean, you look for the person that can easily fit the role. Then you got to make sure that this person fits in the group with the rest of the people. Then you got to make sure that the skills are good, and not just that the skills are good, but they're directable. You can have a great actor that's an asshole, and then you got to think about how that's going to be on your set. And when you're dealing with money out your own pocket or a small budget, you really don't want to add extra stress to that set because there's a lot of people that are doing it because they really want to do it, not because they're looking for a big payday. Then when you get out of that, you got to look at, are they directable? Does the schedule work? Because if you're dealing with a little bit of time and money, you got to make sure the schedule can work out. And if it doesn't work out, it's not like you can say, well, we'll just push the film back to such and such time and then try to fit the schedule because we're not on that level yet. So it's a whole bunch of little things. It's a lot of little small factors that go into it. And it's not really a definitive science to it. It's
right.
Like if all the stars align, they just align.
Yeah.
You know, it's just about how things line up.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. This has been one of the most insightful shows I've ever done. I mean, just the answers have been like just really. I mean, the name of the show is Inside Acting, and you guys really dug deep and got into not just acting but directing, and just give actors out there a real perspective on what it takes, really, you know, in the whole collaborative process between actors and directors. So I just really want to thank you guys again for coming on the show, and thank you, Nikki, for your insightful questions.
Thank you. It's been great.
Yeah. Before I go, I want to let folks know Real Independent Film Extravaganza is coming back this October at West End. We are looking pretty good for stuff this year, October 11th through 17th, so look out for it.
And hopefully Under the Bourbon Moon is going to be a part of that festival, so that should be real dope. And we're putting together another DC screening for Under the Bourbon Moon on August 8th in the city. So definitely, if you're not friends with me on Twitter or Facebook or any of that, Instagram, any of that, find me, Harold Jackson, the number 3, and you can get all the information on the new screening, on pretty much anything, what I'm doing next and what I'm doing now. So, again, thank you.
Okay. Anthony, you had anything else you want to put out there?
We doing good. The new season of Indie Capital will start up in July. Harold is one of the guests on there. It's for, and Manico Barthelemy, Spencer Johnson from Skyrocket, John Gann, Eduardo Sanchez from VHS2, Women in Film and Video. We got a lot of great people. Justin Timpain is on there. Mike Ravinsky from The Next Nick. So we got a great lineup for Indie Capital this year. The Real Independent Festival will be back in October. It is up to Harold if Under the Bourbon Moon is going to be in there.
If you leave it up to me, it's a done deal.
Henchman's War is a lot closer than most people know. I'm just waiting for one more confirmation that I'm letting the word out. The book will be ready to go the end of this month. Henchman's Tales will be ready. And we also got Thick this October.
Okay. And Nikki, anything you want to put out there?
Not at the moment. I'm just actually developing my own short.
Oh, is that right? I did not know that.
Yeah, so it's still draft. It's still in draft form.
Okay. All right, well, Harold, Anthony, Nikki, I just thank you again for coming on the show. It was fantastic, and I'm sure we'll be doing this again sometime, all right?
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Okay, yes, thank you. All right, have a great night. Okay, everybody, I just want to put out there, since it is the 4th of July in about one more hour from here, I've got a couple of good quotes from Thomas Paine. He was a writer back in the 1700s, around the time of the American Revolution, and I have a couple quotes here. The harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. And I have another one here. The world is my country, all mankind are my brethren, and to do good is my religion. All right, and let me also put out there for all you actors out there to do something for your career every day and break a leg. Good night.
This program brought to you by ProSense Productions, creators and producers of the upcoming suspense thriller, The Sick, starring Anna Margulis and Daniel Mascarilla. Visit ProSenseProductions.com for more information on how to get involved or to contribute to the Kickstarter campaign. ProSense Productions. We produce reality from imagination.